Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. To frack or not to frack, that is the question. The economic benefits of hydraulic drilling may well be beyond dispute, but are people justified in fearing its environmental consequences? Will the ground shudder and our water burn? Also, we finally have a doctor who looks his age. What an older, darker doctor could mean for this venerable show. I'm joined in the studio by the Daily Telegraph's Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, Damien Thompson, James Dellingpool, and by the leader of the Green Party, Natalie Bennett. Fracking, often described as the saviour of the British economy, is causing nightmares in the home counties. Villagers are suddenly terrified that drilling for shale gas could make their houses fall down. Traditional Tories are backing a high-profile protest in Bulcombe that, claim the supporters of fracking, has been infiltrated by hardline Green militants. With allegations of NIMBYism and infiltration flying around, this debate has turned into an almighty mess. Well, let's see if our guests can clarify matters. We're joined by James Dellingpole, a pro-fracking blogger, Natalie Bennett, the leader of the Green Party, and, for an economic and global perspective, The Telegraph's Ambrose Evans-Pritchard. If I can start with you, Ambrose, do we need shale? Do we need to do this?
Well, I look at the world and I can see it's been completely transforming for the United States. It's pulled them out of the slump after the Lehman crash. It's slashed their gas costs for industry to about one-third of the level of Europe and a quarter of the level of Japan and Asia. So it's completely transforming. It's very, very hard for a German or Japanese chemical company to even compete any longer. They're having to locate all their plants to America. So you're having a manufacturing renaissance in all these energy-intensive industries, chemicals, in steel and glass and so forth. So it's incredible. It's probably going to create 3 million jobs within 5 years in America. So would it do the same for us? Probably not, because it's an integrated European gas market. Our gas would leak straight to Europe, so the benefit would be spread across Europe. We wouldn't have the same cost advantage. But what it would do is it would greatly narrow our trade deficit. We have an absolutely terrible trade deficit at the moment, one of the worst in the world. That's extremely worrying. We have an unstable recovery. We need to produce things and not just consume.
What could it mean for the people who live on top of shale? I mean, could there be economic benefit for them?
That's just tough.
That's just tough. Okay. Natalie Bennett, it's just tough. This is something we have to do. And people are really rightly worried about rising energy prices and things like that.
Of course they are. And it's absolutely right. And I'm very glad that you acknowledge that Europe is very different to America in terms of that we are part of the global energy market and the prices of gas. The International Energy Agency predicts that the price of gas will rise by 40% by 2020. Gas is a very expensive option. Most of the rise that we've seen in the rise in our energy bills, that we've seen household energy bills over the past decade or so, has been a result of the rise in the cost of gas. Now, I entirely agree with you that we do need to reshape our economy. We need to deal with the trade deficit. But the ways that we need to do that are by doing things like bringing manufacturing back to Britain, manufacturing for ourselves. We need to bring food production back to Britain. All of those, we need to restructure our economy away from those the financial industries and away from services, building up those other sectors. But fracking will not do that for us. The fact is that we actually need to be looking at investing in renewable energies, offshore and onshore wind, solar, and in the future tidal. And those would all be new industries that we can develop, particularly on offshore wind in terms of our expertise, our engineering expertise from offshore oil. We can use that to develop new industries here. And the really important thing that always gets left out because it's not very sexy is energy conservation. And we absolutely must get serious about energy conservation, and that's not what we're doing at the moment.
Ambrose, do you want to respond to that?
Well, look, I would say that I'm personally, I'm in favour of all forms of, developing all forms of alternative energy, including solar, including even wind, which is not very popular for Telegraph readers because I'm afraid of a global energy crunch in the next 10, 15 years. And I'm afraid that's going to cause terrible geostrategic frictions around the world, with China and the US competing head-on. That, for me, is the biggest risk in the world in the next generation. So anything that heads that off is to be welcomed. And if it's windmills, that's fine.
James.
I'd like to congratulate Natalie and the Green Party and their fellow travellers at The Guardian and the BBC and Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace for scoring the most spectacular propaganda coup in persuading the people of the Tory shires that fracking, which is only going to benefit their lives, benefit the economy, is actually something to be feared more greatly than wind farms, for which there is no economic argument, there is no environmental argument, there is no argument whatsoever. It's an extraordinary propaganda coup. They've done so on the basis of misinformation, lies, distortions like we saw in Gasland. Josh Fox, the producer of that and director of Gasland, was 2 years ahead of the game. It's really frightening to me and a frightening example of just how powerful the mendacious but very powerful environmental movement is, that it has been able to get its propaganda in way ahead of the game. For example, the reason that we're seeing these protest groups rising up around Britain now is that some anonymous funder has been booking up village halls and sending round these supposed fracking experts to talk about the dangers of fracking. We don't know who's funding them. What we do know is that the anti-fracking protest industry is richly funded. For example, there's a company, there's the Park Foundation in the US, which pumps millions of dollars into promoting anti-fracking films, etc., etc. We've got Gazprom. Gazprom, the Russian natural gas producer, again, is pumping money into shutting down fracking. We also have the renewables industry. The renewables industry, and this, of course, is why Natalie is so keen, one of the reasons she's so keen to stop fracking. The renewables industry can only be the loser if fracking takes off in Britain, because suddenly people will be asking the questions, hang on a second, we've got this energy on our doorstep. The environmental damage it does is very, very limited. Why the hell are we going for these bat-chomping, bird-slicing eco-crucifixes? It makes no sense whatsoever.
OK, Natalie, there's a lot to pick there. Why is the Green Movement so worried about fracking?
Well, because it has enormous potential local environmental impacts. And I think, you know, Lord Howell, the Lord who is very keen to... It started out in the northeast, but now he thinks we should frack in the remote, desolate northwest. Even he acknowledged that the movements from lorry movements around the country, you're talking about thousands and thousands of lorry movements. We've seen, you know, the impact that's been done in Borkham on the road there already. We're talking about significant risk of spills, significant risk of pollution of aquifers, and also a very important environmental issue. We're talking about, the water companies are very concerned about this. We're talking about each well using potentially around about 1 million gallons of water. Now, we already have significant water stress in Britain, so that's a real problem.
Sorry,
so that's one set of environmental issues.
What evidence do you have whatsoever of any pollution of the aquifers anywhere in the world? There have been over 2 million fracking operations in the US. There has been not one proven or documented case of water of the pollution of the water table by fracking.
Maybe you see that
propaganda movie, but this is just lies. There is no evidence whatsoever.
Okay,
it outrages me that you can just come on with these junk statistics.
Well, let's let Natalie defend those statistics. Where are you getting this evidence
from? Well, there's a very good study in terms of that show signs of methane that's leaked into aquifers.
Nothing to do with...
I'm sorry it has, but I think that's probably too detailed an argument for this setting. But, you know, if you look at a situation, we have whole towns in America where people are feeling the effects, where there's leakages all over the place. And we're told that, you know, oil standards will be much higher here in Britain. But, you know, we're talking about North Sea oil in March. There was 55 reported leaks from our much higher standard North Sea oil and gas wells there. But I think, you know, we have serious environmental, local environmental issues that we need to address and that people are very rightly concerned about. And the people of Balcombe, I've been down there. And, you know, it was amazing the number of people down there who said to me, this is the first protest I've ever been on. People are rightly and fairly concerned about this. But I'd also like to take on...
Because they swallowed your bullshit. That's why.
I'd also like to take on your claims about the power of the Green Movement. I'd love it if we were in the position that you're suggesting. But of course, the groups who are in that position are the oil and gas industry, which have large numbers of lobbyists employed.
I'm familiar with that meme. It's actually, I've spent years writing about this, and I can tell you that big oil puts a lot more money into green issues than it does on my side of the argument. And who was it who sponsored the Guardian Environment pages? It was Shell, I believe.
Well, yes, we might want to talk to the Guardian about whether that was a good idea or not.
Who rebranded themselves beyond petroleum? It was BP.
I'd like to pick a word out of there. Branded. We have some lovely
greenwashing.
Exactly, and that's what the oil companies have been doing while they've continued to push. You know, how come is it these terribly powerless green oil companies got George Osborne to reduce the taxation on fracking from 63% to 30%?
Well, now you do have a friend in government. You do have the Liberal Democrats. You're not entirely locked out of government, are you?
That would be Ed Davey, who has said on two occasions, so it obviously wasn't an accident, I love fracking.
Right.
I don't think the Liberal Democrats can be put
but
up
but they
as,
do
as
also
supporters.
Love wind farms. And we've talked a lot about the potential, which I said, some of it sounded quite speculative. I'd love to know which towns in particular have reported mm-hmm. those things happening in the US. But we talk a lot about the pollutants and the dangers of fracking, but what about the effects of wind farms?
Well, to briefly answer your question, I'd urge people to Google Washington Township in Pennsylvania, and you'll find out some more about that. Sorry, what was the other question? I lost on the other question.
Wind farms do have an environmental impact, which many of our readers are very concerned about. They cover enormous swathes of the countryside. They can kill animals. They can kill birds. There are dangers reported with the noise that they create. This is also something, but we don't hear the Greens or the Liberal Democrats talking about their environmental effects.
Of course, they do have environmental effects, and that's one of the reason why I spend so much time talking about energy conservation, because anything we do, anything to generate energy, will have environmental impacts. That's the nature of as soon as you build a structure, as soon as you start pumping something out or pumping something in, or even, you know, if you dam the Severn and have tidal power there, all of those things will have impacts. So one of the things we absolutely must be doing, and at the moment there's not, for example, one penny of government money going into insulating homes, which is a great way to save energy and reduce our costs in the future, whilst also creating jobs and cutting our carbon emissions at the same time.
But a lot of money does go into subsidising wind jobs. James, you live in a beautiful house in a beautiful part of the countryside. Now, you know the question that's coming, don't you? And it's a good question. What happens if someone wants to build one of these hydraulic drills in your backyard?
Can I give you an interesting statistic? In order to produce the same amount of energy that all the wind turbines in Britain produce would require 10 hectares of land. That's about 10, each fracking site is about a hectare. So just 10 of those would produce as much energy as all the wind farms in Britain. It takes about 2 months for the actual fracking operation to take place, the drilling part of the operation. After that, you put something on top of the fracking hole called a Christmas tree, which is about 6 feet high. Now, I would say that is a lot less disturbing to the landscape than wind turbines, which can be often higher than Salisbury Cathedral spire. And the fracking, the Christmas tree, is not making low-frequency noise, which is giving people insomnia and causing health issues. It is not chopping up birds and bats. And may I say, I admire the skill with which Natalie ducked evaded your question by moving on to energy conservation, which is neither here nor there. The fact is that wind farms do not work on any level whatsoever. They can only survive through massive government subsidy. Unlike fracking, which does not require subsidy because the energy it produces is real and useful. Natalie's probably going to throw me some junk statisticoid about how it is actually subsidised. No, I'm sorry, a tax cut, a reduction in the tax rate is not a subsidy, not in any sensible economist's head. Wind turbines are heavily subsidised. Furthermore, you're a Green, you're supposed to care about CO2 reductions. Actually, it's a fact that in the American economy, the move from coal energy to shale gas energy has resulted in a significant drop in CO2 emissions, if you care about such things. Whereas you are championing wind farms, which do not reduce CO2 emissions because they require constant backup by fossil fuel plants.
Natalie.
They do not displace fossil fuel at all. Shale gas does because it works and it's useful.
People who would listen to Mr. Dellingpole might like to look around the world, look at China, look at America, look at Germany. They're investing in and building huge wind farms. Now, you know, the Germans are people who are pretty good at engineering generally and pretty good at doing their sums. And I think, we are, indeed, it's true that we don't have much wind energy yet in Britain, and that's because we're way behind those other countries, because we haven't invested, we haven't provided the kind of stable.
Germany's also spending a lot of money on coal.
It is, and that's extremely unfortunate, and we'd like to see that changing very fast. But in terms of Britain, you know, the situation we have is we have now still before Parliament, the Lords, the Energy Bill. And what we need written into that Energy Bill is a phrase that says decarbonisation of the electricity supply by 2030. And if we do that, we provide the security of investment in environment that will then ensure we have strong investment in the future of renewable energy in Britain. And you don't just have to listen to me on that. You can listen to the CBI, the Confederation on British Industry, on that too.
Ambrose, do you think this talk of decarbonising the British economy, about making it greener, is really realistic?
Well, I'd just like to make a point first about Germany, because I'm not sure it's a very good example, actually, what they're doing. There are a lot of industrialists and businessmen in Germany who think the country's made a catastrophic error, and that this could cause a systemic crisis in Germany within a decade, because they're just pricing themselves out of global markets. And the electricity they're betting on that's coming from the Baltic, from wind power and so forth, they don't have the cables in place. It's extremely expensive. They're just being undercut left, right and centre. And Germany's actually really in danger, I think, of going into an energy crisis just at the same time it goes into an ageing crisis, and just really just fall off the bottom of the global economy within 10 years.
Well, I think what we have to look at here is the situation that... That's Germany has made a choice. Germany has done pretty well economically over the past few decades. And what they've also done is acknowledge that we absolutely must cut our carbon emissions. And the elephant in the room we haven't yet mentioned yet, of course, is climate change. And we absolutely must cut our global emissions. And the fact is, if you look at Carbon Tracker, for example, 60 to 80% of our fossil fuel reserves that we know about now have to stay in the ground if we're going to avoid catastrophic climate change.
Well, Germany's done us a great favour on solar power, because it's invested a huge amount of money in improving solar technology, but its own industry is completely bankrupt. There's almost no German solar companies left. They've been wiped out by China. So they didn't get any of the benefits of it.
James, in your gut, what do you think is motivating this opposition to fracking?
It's partly ideological. I mean, the Green Party is essentially... a variation on the Communist Party with a different colouring to it. It is ultimately anti-Western industrial civilization, anti-growth. So it's partly this crazed religious ideology, and partly I would say it's vested interests. There is so much money to be made from rent seeking out of at the taxpayers' expense, out of renewable energy, the renewable energy scam, that these vested interests do not want the gravy train to stop. They want to keep their snouts in the trough. And shale gas is a real threat to that.
Natalie, to conclude, James actually makes a very good point there, that you often pitch yourselves as being on the side of the little people, and I'm sure that you are in many cases, but there actually are economic vested interests in opposing fracking and supporting renewable energies. I mean, it costs in subsidies something like £100,000 to subsidise every wind jobs. There are people living on country estates who make millions, literally millions, out of allowing people to put wind turbines on there. And we find ourselves in the extraordinary situation in Scotland, for example, where... if the wind turbine produces too much, the government actually pays people to switch it off so that it doesn't overload the grid. You are the friend of very rich people.
Well, let's look at the actual physical realities of people's bills today. The average, if you have a dual fuel bill, daily you're paying 14p a day in subsidy to the wind industry. 14p. You are currently paying 48p a day for subsidy for cleaning up the old nuclear industries. 14p for wind, 48p for old nuclear. So that puts this into context. And you know, we can't make another mess. And the fact is that we know if we lock ourselves into a gas energy future, go back to the International Energy Agency, gas prices predicted to rise by 40% by 2020. If we lock ourselves into gas, then we're having volatile, high-cost bills for everybody in the future. Whereas if we go for the renewable option, then what we have is we know what the sun, the wind and the tide is going to cost forever. There's not going to be inflation in the prices. And so we can have that certainty. And very importantly, we can do the energy conservation and you know, save people money, create jobs and cut carbon emissions.
Hang on a second. Every wind turbine operates at the level of 100% subsidy. That's onshore wind. Offshore wind, 200% subsidy. The industry would collapse without being bankrolled by the taxpayer. It is not economically viable. So I don't know how you can talk in this. This is one of the things that really bothers me about you Greens, that you have you make these statements and you're talking about a parallel universe which bears no relation to life as she is lived. Real people out there need energy for their computers. Business needs cheap energy to compete abroad. It's a nonsense. You're driving up energy prices. One more thing, because wind energy is so intermittent and unreliable, we now have a ridiculous situation where banks of diesel generators are being put in sites all over the country in order to provide the backup energy when the wind isn't blowing. Now, there could be nothing dirtier than diesel generator energy. This is nonsense.
Natalie, I'll give you the last word on that.
The fact is that if we have incredibly rich wind resources in Britain, we have some of the richest wind resources in the world. And in any one place, of course, it's intermittent. But if you look hooked up to your European grid, if you have solar, if you have a mix of energy sources, including tidal, which is, of course, entirely reliable, then what you can do is build a system that works. And we need to get to that totally decarbonated system by 2030. And it can be done. And we have to do it for reasons of cost, for reasons of the environment locally and the global environment. We must avoid catastrophic climate change.
Natalie Bennett, James Dellingpool and Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, thank you very much. Peter Capaldi has been unveiled as the new Doctor Who, with some speculation that he might be a grumpier, swearier Time Lord. He's certainly older. At 55, Capaldi is only a few months younger than the very first Doctor Who, played by the misanthropic William Hartnell. So what will the effect be of having a veteran actor playing the part, rather than the usual Blue Peter-style teen icon? And why, oh why, must the Doctor always be played by a man? Damien Thompson, what do you think of Capaldi?
I was delighted when I heard the news, not because I'm a particular fan of his, but because he's 55. And that means that Doctor Who is older than me, which is a really fantastic feeling. I mean, as you know, I'm in my late 20s, and it's rather alarming, the thought that Doctor Who would be younger than me. So I think middle-aged men everywhere were rather heartened by the thought of an imposing, perhaps sarcastic, sardonic Doctor who has a more interesting relationship with his audience than just being, as you say, a Blue Peter presenter.
Do you think this sort of goes back to the past when it was run by, when the characters were played by middle-aged men like William Hartnell and John Pertwee and Pat Troughton?
Absolutely. But, I mean, John Pertwee, for me, was the very model of a Doctor Who.
Yeah, he's the Roger Moore of Doctor Who.
What I liked about him was that, you know, you had that sort of, it was big hair, let's be honest. You had that sort of Danny LaRue hairdo, and you had the wonderful frilly shirt from Mr. Fish. But actually, he wasn't camp. He was quiet and authoritative. And actually, there was occasionally the slight frisson, slight suggestion of romantic interest with Joe Grant or whoever. But it was never spelt out. Now, on the downside, looking as I do many years later at these programmes, I have to say the monsters do look as if John Noakes had knocked them up in the Blue Peter set a few days earlier.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the new series, that's from Christopher Eccleston onwards, has given us enormously greater pace and enormously more impressive special effects. It could hardly be less impressive. But we've lost something, because instead of plots, what you have are people endlessly rushing around like, I don't know, like the Road Runner.
I do sometimes wonder if the entire cast are on ecstasy or something. Every episode should come with an epilepsy warning. I can't make out what the heck's going on in every episode. And I think a really important point that people forget, because you've been talking about John Pertwee, is back in the good old days, you know, when Britain was Britain as it should be, when it was run by Jim Callaghan and Roger Moore was James Bond, and, you know, everyone sat and watched the same programme on BBC One. In those days, a Doctor Who serial, a story, could last six or even eight episodes stretched over one week after another. Whereas this show, which touts itself as sophisticated drama, covers the saving of the universe in 45 minutes. And I think that's one of the reasons why it seems so rushed.
Well, sometimes the universe is saved three or four times during the course of a single episode.
Yeah.
And the jumping around from one historical setting to another is a bit schizophrenic these days, actually, rather than convincing.
Yeah.
So, has it reverted to being a kids' show? I don't know. But I would like to see Doctor Who return to, I don't know, some recover some of the sort of quizzical authority of perhaps Sherlock Holmes. I've always rather been interested in.
And also a character, a Doctor who's a bit of a mystery. I mean, we always forget the Who bit of his name. Everyone's always going on about his qualifications as a Doctor, but the Who bit was always the great mystery that was hanging over
Absolutely.
The Doctor.
Absolutely. I mean, one looked at John Pertwee and one thought,
what the hell's he about?
Where did you get that shirt?
Yes, yes, yes. But you're quite right when you said, because, you know, we're both Pertwee files, you know, we've spent many an evening watching old Pertwee's.
Well, you've got the hair.
I do have the hair. I also have the jackets, if I'm honest. But one of the things about Pertwee was he was deadly serious in the way he did the role. Now, Matt Smith always does it, and David Tennant, in this sort of comic, clownish, sort of Frankie Howard kind of way. I never felt they took the part seriously.
Nor did I. And actually, one of the things that made Pertwee's Doctor Who rather serious is he had a most magnificent antagonist in the form of Roger Delgado's master. Now, Delgado, friend of Pertwee's, splendid, authoritative, sinister yet charming actor.
Quite sexy.
It's clear that there had been some sort of friendship between the master and the Doctor before the master had turned to evil. And when you had those two men on set, irrespective of how lumpy the script might be.
Yeah.
It was absolutely electric.
And nowadays, there's so much overt sexuality in Doctor Who. You know, that's not a comment on whatever kind of sexuality it is, although the Doctor did once hit on a tree woman, which I think is just perverse. But there's so much overt sexuality. The companion's always falling in love with the Doctor and saying, I love you. Whereas back then it did exist, but it was a frisson. There is a wonderful serial, The Time Monster, where the Master gets it on with the Queen of Atlantis, played by Ingrid Pitt. Now, there is no greater 70s combination of Roger Delgado and Ingrid Pitt. So it was quite adult back then.
But I agree with you that the hints of sexuality and danger were, shall we say, boiled down to a single gesture, which, curiously enough, Roger Moore, John Pertwee, and Roger Delgado were all expert at, and that's the lifting of
the
raised eyebrow.
Now, could a woman ever play this part?
I think if a woman played the part, we'd spend all our time thinking, ooh, it's a woman Doctor Who.
Right.
And it would be a distraction.
I think it depends on who the woman is. I hate the new series so much that if they somehow resurrected Beryl Reed or possibly Margaret Rutherford...
Margaret Rutherford would have made a splendid
It would have
Doctor,
rescued
I
it. I'd love the Doctor to be played by a fusty 50-year-old woman with an umbrella who sort of hits Daleks and children with it and says, get moving. Anne Widdecombe would have made a marvellous Doctor.
I think Anne Widdecombe would have sort of shown off in the way that she does. I mean, she's basically a panto creature and she would have turned it into a panto show. Noel Gordon, now you're talking.
Oh, my goodness, yes, that would be wonderful. And possibly Kate O'Mara. We're just going down the camp icon route now.
Well, there's another eyebrow raiser for you.
There she has risen.
Is she no longer with us?
No, I think Kate O'Mara is still very much alive, and I'm sure propping up the bar in Saint-Tropez right now with a big grin on her face listening to this. Damien Thompson, for all your advice on Doctor Who, thank you so much.
Thanks.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.